Thanks for joining us. My name is Ibrahim Sani. You're watching Notepad in our special segment called The Economics of Elections, where we unpack some of the policy issues following this general election. Joining me in the studio is Dato' Nitin Nadkarni. He is, of course, a senior partner at Lee Hishamuddin Allen and Gladhill. Dato', there's a lot of things that we need to talk about when it comes to the economic policies. That is rather scant, in my opinion, coming in from the manifestos of these kind of candidates. But many of them aspire to join the ranks of those governments that is going to bring about good economic policies in this very tumultuous 2023. My question to you is, my first question to you is, they really need to address some hot potatoes, hot political potatoes like GST, the powers that is being given to, say, for instance, the Inland Revenue Board and many others. Where do you think the issue of GST is going to stand when it comes to those that come into power? Do you think they're going to institute it, say, for instance, the first day that they get power?
Okay. Well, hello, and thank you for having me on the show, Ibrahim. I think nobody is going to talk about GST, because it is the ultimate vote loser. But the reality is we have a huge budget deficit, 100 billion ringgit budget deficit between revenue and expenditure. Cutting expenditure is politically very difficult, so you have to increase revenue. And the only way you can really increase revenue is with a form of GST. Whatever name you want to call it, they probably won't even call it GST. But in my view, the economic pressures are such that any government of any complexion that comes in will have to seriously consider reinstituting GST in Malaysia.
What was surprising was that the budget that was presented a few weeks ago, was absent in terms of GST. Do you think that they know that they have to do GST, but they just don't want to mention it because it being the political year right now that we are facing?
Yes, absolutely right. 2018, the government changed. The opposition won for the first time in history, partly, to a very large extent, in fact, because of the anger amongst the public about GST. So it's a political hot potato. But if you look at what the finance minister actually said, I think on the 7th of October, he was reported to have said that the government will consider GST next year. Of course, once Parliament was dissolved, he then went on to say, well, the cabinet has never actually discussed this. But you notice none of the parties are talking about it, whether they want to implement it or don't want to implement it. That's because reality is that they have to implement it, and nobody wants to make a commitment that they won't implement it.
Okay, let's talk about the mechanics of things right now. There are a lot of pedestrian conversations into how Budget 2023 is going to be instituted. Is it would the new or incoming finance minister have to retable it in the parliament? Are they able to introduce a fresh budget? Or can they just copy-paste whatever that Zaf presented a few weeks ago and then just said that we're running with this for now? I'll come back to you with a fresher one in 2024.
Okay, well, let's look at it historically. In 1999, Tun Mahathir did exactly the same thing. He presented a budget at the end of, in October 1999. He then dissolved Parliament. And then in 2000, the same budget was re-presented. But everybody knew in 1999 that Tun Dr. Mahathir would still be the Prime Minister after the elections. The only question was how many seats he would have. The big issue then was that whether he was going to lose the two-thirds majority. But that he would be in power was no question. Today the situation is somewhat different. First of all, we don't know who is going to be the Prime Minister after the election. We don't know which party is going to win after the election. We don't know whether they will have a huge majority, whoever wins, or whether it will be a coalition government which has to balance different expectations. So that's the first distinction. The second distinction, the finance minister was quoted in the Malay Mail just yesterday saying that, well, of course they may have to reconsider the budget in light of circumstances when it is presented, and they may have to tweak the budget. So that's a hint that there may be some changes. The third thing is, what do they actually do? Will they present the budget immediately on the at the end of November, or will they have a mini budget to just cover cash flow for 2 or 3 months and then present a fresh budget in January or February next year. If they do the latter, then the chances are that there will be some serious changes to the budget.
What about the legality of things? Is it required or upon the incumbent government to reintroduce the budget, or can they just say, you know, by law we can go with whatever that Tengku Zafrul has presented? Or is it required by legislation to present a new budget for the parliament to approve?
Well, if there isn't a budget, then there's no government expenditure. Government will come crashing to a halt. You won't pay civil servants their salaries. You won't have development expenditure. Contractors won't get paid for work they've done for the government. So you have to have a finance act that sets out where the government is going to collect revenues and how those revenues are to be spent. But as I say, you can have a full budget that sets out how this is going to happen over the next 12 months, or you can have a mini budget, a bridging budget, which just governs for the next one or two months while they retweak the entire budget. And that is the question of what they're going to do. If you have an entirely new government with a new prime minister, you may well see the latter situation, where you have a mini budget just to cover cash flow for a couple of months while they present design and present an entirely new budget.
Yeah, in terms of the parallels to the 1999 situation, Tun Da'in presented the same budget, but it was presented in February.
That's right.
Not late of that particular year, in 1999. Because of this, that cash flow conversation that you were mentioning was just enough to cover, say, for instance, the first 2 months of the year 2000. But again, there's a lot of continuity in terms of who's running the office. But this time round, because of the unexpected or tumultuous kind of results that might come up from the election, we might not necessarily see any semblance of the same government coming back, or we might just get the same folks again. Because of this uncertainty, how does this derail the growth of the nation? We still need to grow. We still need to see some development coming in. 2023 is going to be the year of recession globally. We are not spared from that. We are still, as I checked, part of this globe. And therefore, we have to understand how this is going to impact the folks out there. Jobs, contractors, doctors, they need to get paid. My sister-in-law is not hired, even though she has graduated with an MBBS. She's not hired. She just graduated. So, there's a lot of, you know, bread and butter issues that needs to be resolved. How do you see the issue resolving? And what must, say, for instance, the three big coalitions, Pakatan, Harapan, BN and PN, need to address first, not just through the political lens, but right now, the operational part? What should be the key points that they need to address right now?
Well, the thing that they'll have to address immediately is to keep the cash flowing. To take that same precedent you mentioned in 1999, there was a little mini budget to cover the cash flow over those 3 months. Then they will have to consider, if you get the same prime minister, the same finance minister, you might probably see the very same budget being represented very quickly, and this conversation will basically become irrelevant. If you have a different prime minister, even from the same ruling party, or you have a different prime minister from a different party, as I say, you will probably see a very different budget. Having said that, I think the room for maneuver is very limited, whoever comes into power. As you said, we're part of the globe. We are subject to the same economic forces that affect every country around the world. The things we have to spend money on, the operational expenditure has to go on. There's not much you can do with operational expenditure. You cannot cut spending going into a recession. Keynes taught us that, 70 years ago, that in a recession you spend more money to keep the economy afloat. So there's very little that they can do. Whoever comes in can tweak a little here, can say, no, I want to spend a little bit more on subsidies, or I want to spend a little less on subsidies, or I want to target the subsidies.
Window dressing, it's not...
That's it. Yeah. But there's very little room for maneuver on the expenditure side. Where there is a great deal of scope for a government coming in is on the revenue side. We have a $100 billion budget deficit. And as we saw in the UK just recently, even the world's fifth largest economy, when they presented a budget that did not balance income with expenditure, you saw a market crisis. And within 6 weeks, the prime minister was out. I think the whole world has woken up to that.
Yeah.
So whoever comes in is going to have to find a way of increasing the revenue flow to match the expenditure that is going to have to be taken.
You know, yeah, it's not just about the revenue. I mean, we started off this conversation with the GST. That's one thing. There's also that whole widening of the narrow tax base that we are currently facing. About 10% of Malaysians who are currently working are actually paying tax. 90% are not paying tax.
Correct.
You know, there's so many things that are wrong when it comes to collection of taxes. But of course, there's the whole issue of expenditure. Yes, operating expenditure is, you know, there's not much wiggle room there. But think about this. Subsidies have risen year on year. This year, 80 billion has been spent. I don't really trust that number because that 80 billion was uttered by the caretaker finance minister a few months ago. I'm pretty sure it has breached 100 billion already as we speak right now, perhaps even more. I would be very surprised if that number shrank for the entire year of 2020 because, as you know, prices are not elastic when it goes down. If anything, it's going to be at least 100 billion subsidies next year, if not bigger. More so because of the global recession that is currently happening. It looks really scary, Dato. I'm not really optimistic at all about whoever that comes into the government right now. I really am not optimistic. I don't know why, in fact, anybody wants to contest in this election. Why would you? It's a lot to carry on your shoulders, you know? What do you think about this? I mean, I'm a concerned citizen. And, you know, I've said it on my Twitter account. I am a Sungai Buloh voter. I am facing a very strange predicament on the ballot paper. I really am. I am, yeah.
Sure.
I thought I knew who to vote for, and then this happened, and then I'm like, ugh.
But I can only talk about the tax situation and where I see taxes going. The point is this, that you have to spend money. You can't broaden the income tax base. As Syed Siddiq, there's a clip going around of Syed Siddiq saying quite correctly that wages are too low in Malaysia. They really haven't risen in Malaysia. So you cannot tax, you cannot expand the tax base because not enough people earn money, have good, well-paying jobs that they can pay income tax. So you have to find alternative means of raising income, for the government. That's why I keep coming back to the GST. But it's not the only tax. The other tax that governments have been considering for quite a while, before the 2018 election, I think it is, there was a PowerPoint presentation floating around from one of the big international consultancies in Singapore, where they were floating the idea of reintroducing inheritance tax. As you know, we had inheritance tax in Malaysia until about 1990, when it was abolished by Tun Dr. Mahathir. Here's how I think a populist government would play it. They'd bring in a form of GST, but of course you always get the howl saying, oh, you're making the poor people pay. To balance that out, I suspect a populist government would bring in inheritance tax at the same time to say, you see, we're also soaking the rich. Inheritance tax won't actually raise much money, but it'll be a very popular move politically.
Yeah, it gives a good signal.
It gives a good signal that everybody is carrying their fair share of the burden. I suspect that that's how some people might play this. Some politicians might play this.
What about other forms of revenue other than this possibility of signaling to the market that inheritance tax is going to come back into the frame?
There are other things that can be brought in. Capital gains tax.
Ah, okay.
That's the, if you think about it, we have real property gains tax only. And real property gains tax was brought in the 1970s for the purpose of curbing land speculation. Yeah. It wasn't a revenue generating measure. And so that's why if you hold an individual who holds property for 5 years, pays no RPGT. Even a company only pays about 5% if you hold it for more than 5 years.
So you completely take out the speculators, the rent seekers.
So you take out the rent seekers, those who want to flip properties. But if you implemented a capital, but there's no reason why it should only be
on property.
If you move to a system, we haven't quite got there, but if you look at the US, a lot of revenue of senior people comes in the form of shares that are vested rather than cash. They get share options. Should that be subject to capital gains tax?
It should.
That's one question. Other assets that you may buy, people who buy an expensive Patek Philippe, just to take an example, which they paid a million ringgit on, but which, due to Bitcoin speculation, now is worth 10 million and they sell it. You know, a hardworking wage earner, a doctor who works 14, 16 hours a day, has to pay income tax. should a chap who made money on an escalation in the price of a Patek Philippe have to pay tax on it? So these are questions. Capital gains tax, again, will raise some revenue. It won't raise that much revenue.
Again, it's a good signal to the market.
But it's a good, it's a balance. There is pros and cons. One part, if you bring in capital gains tax, where it will really impinge is on share transactions.
Okay.
Right now, people who buy and sell shares, unless they are trading in shares, pay no tax on gains if you play the stock market. If you bring in a CGT, there is a lot of people who say this will dampen interest in the stock market. And, you know, our stock market is really not performing. If you remember, pre-1997, the KLSE, as it was then known, was the second largest stock exchange in Asia, if you exclude Japan. Today, it's not even on the radar. Nobody cares about us. So I don't know the extent to which this argument that it would dampen speculation is valid, because we really don't have a lot of people who are interested in the stock market. So there is an argument.
No, a lot of people are interested in the stock market.
But they're not
interested.
They're
not interested in the KLSE.
KLSE. In Bursa. So, you know, there's a place you could raise revenue, for example. But again, and I come back to this point, it will not raise as much as a value-added tax, a GST, no matter how you call it. GST has so many good things. Aside from the revenue it raises, it also forces a large part of the black economy
To come out.
And to come out.
Yeah.
So, you know, people who were taking cash payments and not declaring income tax are forced to do that. A classic example, since we're talking about doctors, and I come from a medical family, so people shouldn't be upset. So it forced
the,
a lot of doctors.
You're
it
the
forced
guy
a lot
that didn't make it as a doctor.
I am the guy. I'm from an Indian family, so my grandfather, my father, my brother, and my nephew are all doctors. I'm the failure who became a lawyer. So you know, it forces lawyers. There are lawyers who evade tax. Or avoid, not evade, it forces them out into the public. So it has enormous, there are a lot of good things it does. But perhaps the way it was implemented was bad.
Let's talk about the implementation process before. We've had a lesson, I suppose. We've had a tuition center kind of thing. LHDN was not part of the picture, or IRB. It was done by the customs.
That's correct.
And there are some nuances that the LHDN is gaining too much power, has too broad of a scope of authority. Where do you stand on this?
The tax laws, the Malaysian Income Tax Act was passed in 1967. I was 5 years old at the time. There are probably nobody who paid taxes in 1967, who is still paying taxes today. It is time for a wholesale change. In 1967, you know, things were very, very different. And in particular, the protections given to taxpayers under the Income Tax Act are pathetic. Let me give you an example. And I do the tax litigation, so I'll tell you this is how it works. I've got clients who were assessed for transactions in 2012 who still haven't had their cases heard. And that's because Income Tax Act, you see, the courts, the KL High Court, under the Chief Justice, two or three Chief Justices, have become incredibly efficient. You file a case in the KL High Court, you're heard within a year.
Yeah.
Tax cases can take 10 years.
Why is that?
Well, it's a special court you have to go to. So there's a process. They give you an assessment. You then file a notice of appeal. The Inland Revenue can sit on your notice of appeal for 1 year while they think about, they go through their internal process, the dispute resolution process.
Think about to proceed or not.
Whether to forward your appeal to the tax court, the Special Commissioners of Income Tax. At the end of 1 year, they forward your appeal. Then it goes to Special Commissioners and you're in a queue. So you think about it, there's a huge backlog in the Special Commissioners of Income Tax. First of all, we had the pandemic, and unlike the KL High Court, which was able to smoothly move into online hearings and still continues a lot of hearings online, the Special Commissioners weren't given the finances by the Ministry of Finance to equip them to do online hearings. So you had a backlog built up during the pandemic. Secondly, judges of the Special Commissioners are appointed by the Ministry of Finance, not by the Chief Justice. So it's up to them how many judges they want to appoint. So we had six judges earlier this year. Four of them retired, or their contracts weren't renewed. We only have two. We don't know whether their contracts will be renewed. So again, you have a backlog building up. Cases, the case I was giving you of a person whose transaction in 2012 was taxed, his case was fixed for hearing last month. It was postponed because there were no judges to hear it. It would probably take another year. Then you have the Revenue Council. They are tremendously overworked. And we'll get into why, because the Inland Revenue has taken a very, assessing officers have taken a very aggressive approach in taxing people. That increases the workload for the Revenue Council. And, you know, they can only do so many cases at a time. So when you're fixing cases, they have to have free dates. And I don't fault them. They work extremely hard, but they're pushed.
But when you have a capacity, you have a capacity.
You have a capacity. And you're pushed. So you're trying to match diary dates of Revenue Council, the limited number of tax judges that there are. So you have enormous delays. Now let's assume we win. And I'll give you a true life examples. You win before the special commissioners. They don't pay you your money back because they appeal to the High Court. And while the appeal is pending, the revenue says, I'm not going to pay you your money back. They lose in the High Court, and these are real life cases. They then appeal to the Court of Appeal. And they don't pay you your money back while you're pending appeal to the Court of Appeal. Eventually, you win at the Court of Appeal. Then you get your money back, but you don't get any interest. So imagine that you paid that money to the Inland Revenue, because when you're assessed, you have to pay within 30 days. You paid that money to the Inland Revenue, let's say in 2015. You get your money back in 2024 with no interest. What is the real value of that money?
It's depreciated, of course.
Enormously.
So, practically.
We lived in 1967 in a very gentle world where everything took their time. Everybody took their time.
There was the Cold War.
Business took things. You know, business was very casual. Today, to businesses, time is money. And things are, it's very important. Their cash flow is critical. So when you have this setup, it is extremely unfair to taxpayers. And I've acted for a lot of taxpayers who've won at every level but had to wait 8-10 years to get their money back with no interest. So you tell me, is that fair? Is that fair on a taxpayer?
It's not. I'm a taxpayer.
Yeah. And if you're a business and you face cash flow crunches because of this, and sometimes there are huge taxes raised and they can slap a 40-45% penalty on top. You get it back 8-10 years later. How fair is that? There are some shortcuts. You can go to the High Court in very limited circumstances. You can bypass this process. But only in very limited circumstances you can go straight to
the High Court. I sometimes subject myself to self-flagellation. In this way, I look at and read manifestos given by the political parties. It's no fun to read. I have read, not briefly, but extensively over the past 1 or 2 days. Some of them have indeed publicly pronounced their manifestos. None of this is mentioned in their manifestos. None. So I don't know whether they are clueless on this topic, or perhaps they have sussed up the market and the majority, the vast majority, might not necessarily care about what you are talking about right now.
You're right. And that's another very good reason why GST was such a good tax. As you said, only 10% of people pay income tax. 90% of people don't care about what happens in the income tax world. They don't care because they're not subject. Everybody paid GST. That made everybody a responsible citizen. Every single person said, what's happening to my tax money? You please account to me. So GST made the government accountable to every citizen in a way that income tax never did. Secondly, one of the big complaints about GST was the fact that customs, and maybe they were overwhelmed, I'm not being critical, but GST refunds took a very, very long time. A lot of people who were owed money weren't paid money. So again, a much bigger pool of people said, I'm concerned about this, I'm angry about this, I want accountability from the government on this issue. In a way that you never saw on income tax, that you will not see for inheritance tax, that you will not see for any other tax. It's very important to make people into responsible citizens, and I'm probably going to get pilloried for saying that.
No. I think people are shouting on the TV screens right now hearing you speak. I honestly do. Do you feel that there's two or three things that they need to think about when it comes to government income, government spending, policies, powers that is instituted to institutions like LHD and many more? Where do you think the voter should be concerned about right now?
I think the voters ought to be concerned about these things. I don't think the voters care about these things. The vast majority of voters are only interested in what's in it for me, the expenditure side.
Okay.
I think the vast majority of voters don't look at the tax side, the income side for the government.
It's only natural, unfortunately.
It's only natural. People look at, what do I get out of this? What's in it for me in this budget? So because of that, if you look at the election campaign that'll come, BN will say, look at all these wonderful goodies we're giving you. For the youth, we're giving you each 200 ringgit into your e-wallets. For civil servants, we're going to give you a 700 ringgit Raya bonus. For pensioners, we're going to give you some money. For women, we're going to give you, those who've gone out of the workplace and come back into the workplace, we're going to give you a tax holiday. For, you know, so there's a number of these goodies that they're giving out. So that's the BN approach. And it's very effective, vote winning. You give me cash, I'm happy. Mm. I get the money. Of course, both PN, and PH, it's such an alphabet soup, have said, no, these are just empty promises. Budget wasn't passed, so there's no guarantee you're going to get all of these things. And that's what they're going to say, first of all. Mm. These are meaningless promises. These are the sweet nothings that are being whispered in your ear. Mm. I think the other thing that perhaps some of them are saying, I think Lim Kit Siang was quoted as saying, is that what you're doing, if I can put it in colloquial terms, is you're giving people one fish that they can eat today. But you're not, in this budget, looking at the longer things of giving people the ability, not training them how to fish, but giving them the ability to go to the river and fish. That is, you're not doing things that improve our long-term productivity, our long-term competitiveness, and that most importantly, I think, are creating good, well-paying jobs for the ordinary citizen. And that's what we lack. There is such a huge competition for talent going on right now. I've seen it. I've got people who worked for me for a year or two in tax. One young gentleman who went to a Chinese school and then went to UKM, did all his law, all his life spent in Malaysia, was recruited to go and work in Sydney by one of the big consulting firms. You know, so there's and I've got others who've been recruited to Singapore, to China, to all over the place. And the reason for that is because we just are not paying, we're not able to pay people well enough to stay here by comparison to our competitors. And that's graduates. You think about your clerks, your clerks, your non-graduate. Yeah. They are really worst paid off. Badly in a time when inflation is raging at, 10%? Mm. We really need to create better paying jobs. And I don't think any of our political parties, some have shouted that the budget isn't doing it, but I don't think any of them have focused their attention on how should it be done.
The mechanics of it. Fantastic. Plenty to think about. That was Datuk Nitin Nadkarni, the senior partner at Lee Shamuddin, Allen and Glen Hill. See, I pronounced it right. If you missed any part of this interview, just head on to astronomy.com. There's plenty of conversations like this that can be found there. Also, go to astronomy.com, look for The Economics of Elections, a sub-program under my own show, Notepad. Until then, thanks very much for watching. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Stay tuned and stay on Astro Awani, your GE15 channel.